Hello, my name is Dr. Marla Dubinsky, and I'm going to bring you the key insights from the great debates and updates in inflammatory bowel disease meeting that was held here in Dallas. And I'm here with Dr. Thamos Tassopoulos, who's one of the course directors, who comes from Baylor University Medical Center at Dallas.
Great. Thank you for having me, Marla.
So what I thought we'd do today is we're just going to kind of go through the meeting and maybe share with our listeners and our viewers some of the key insights that both you and I took away from the different aspects of the meeting. We started the day in the morning talking about transitions, transition of care predominantly. There was also some transition through different aspects of life, but we'll focus on transition of care and thinking about what are the key elements that will improve the transition. So from me sending, as a pediatric gastroenterologist, sending what I think is a child who's ready to be transitioned to adult management, or someone who I'm sending from New York to who's going to school in Texas. What are the specific elements that you feel the pediatric gastroenterologist could help you help make that best transition for the patient?
You know, as you know, Marla, a transition is exactly that. It's not a sudden change of physicians or location, but it's actually a process that takes probably, you have more experience in that than me, months or years. Mm-hmm. It's in the making. And you in the pediatric world and other pediatric gastroenterologists start that process probably ahead of time. So we're really dependent on the pediatric team to prepare the patient. Beyond that, what I find helpful is a letter, a call. Definitely the outside medical records for us to review so as to understand, again, the nature of the disease, but also to get to know the patient, the family, issues that have surrounded the management of the patient. I think it's really important for us to tailor the visit to, like any other patient, but even more so in that setting, to the needs and specific issues in the minds of on the mind of the patient and the family. It's definitely important to have a pleasant interview that is not rushed. To be open, to give material, to also work with the staff in terms of telling them ahead of time who is coming today, and that this is a really critical time in their illness experience, and we really want to have that. You never you get only one chance to make a first impression, and so I think that listening actively, spending plenty of time, maybe switching more to a more compassionate, less on the adult business-like mm-hmm. approach, really trying to, in our minds, think of the compassion part of IBD is really important.
So one of the things, you know, historically, transition, or actually transfer, which is what you were kind of getting to, that transfer is that transaction where you take pediatric care provider and the patient now is in front of an adult care provider. And you're asking that there's good medical documentation, medical records, so when the transfer occurs, you have what you need to make sure that the transition is smooth, because that is a very vulnerable time in an IBD patient's life, right? They go from a cocoon-like, not as much autonomous care profile and support to, all right, you're now 18, and you all of a sudden are in charge of your disease. So one of the things that Robin Sokolow from Cornell taught us is that one of our jobs as pediatric gastroenterologists is to start early. You know, start even at the age of 10 to 14, know your milestones. There's a NASPGHAN milestones document or checklist where it's kind of like between the age of 10 to 12, you do this. Between 12 and 14, you should be doing this. And, you know, using age as a way to where you start educating and developing your patient, getting them ready. But one of the other things that we realize, and Laura Kiefer, who is also a guest speaker at the meeting, talks a lot about how resilient you are, and noted that age is probably not the most important factor for a successful transition, but more about how confident and knowledgeable the patient is about their disease. Because if we don't, as pediatric GIs, don't prepare the child and start giving them some autonomy in their care, it will impact how good you are at, you know, managing that patient. And trying to explain that the parents as well, because we got the parent aspect and the caregivers, that we need to start distancing parents from the care and having the child kind of take the driver's seat. And that's on us. So I think we both agree that there has to be some give on both of our ends with the patient in the middle and using the behavioral health team to maybe make sure they're confident that they are educated about their medications, they know where the disease is, they know what they have, so that they're not just sitting in front of you and going, I don't know, I'll check. Or, you know, we want them to have that power. So I think one of the teaching points for me about transition was that we need to do a better job as PGIs to get them ready for the actual transfer of care.
What mistakes have you seen adult gastroenterologists make? What can you tell us we as adult gastroenterologists do better? Because again, I think that you guys carry most of this prep work, and we sort of take it from there. But you know, I'm sure there are some steps that we can improve.
So I think one of the things that the feedback I would get, for example, would be the office was hard to reach. Because you tend to, maybe some pediatricians' offices work a little bit differently. The volume is typically less, so maybe it's just the phone call back is not as quick, for example, or they can't get a hold of someone for a refill. Though I think having a way that the patient knows how to get a hold of the team is important. For them not to land in the office and then say, we're going to scope you because I don't know anything about your disease. There's a lot of patients that would be like, running away, right? And they'd be like, all he wanted to do was scope me. You told me, meaning to me as a pediatric gastroenterologist, that that's not going to be the first thing they want to do. So I think maybe, as you noted, just trying to get to know the patient and how autonomous they really are before thinking they must be autonomous because they're sitting in your chair.
I think also the transition of biologics is important because whenever you switch physician, they may be in a different insurance program, and I think making sure that everything is set up so that there's no delay in the infusion of whatever biologic or in the filling of any prescriptions. You know, again, transitions are stages where there's a lot of confusion.
Yeah.
Who's going to prescribe this now and when? And I think that I definitely learned the same thing from Dr. Sokolow's lecture today, that it's emotional intelligence, resilience, knowledge of the illness that that are predictors of a successful transition, and we should continue on that path as we take over the care of the patient.
You know, because we spend so much time getting them ready, so...
Yes,
you said.
Of course.
So, and a lot of that, and also Dr. Kiefer really emphasized the idea of resilience, and I think that's the way that we're approaching patients. She was very provocative. She said that if our outcome, meaning ours, should be to treat to prevent depression and anxiety, not try and manage depression and anxiety. So if we could kind of predict or use factors that actually predict which patients are, that's the target she says we should be trying to achieve, which is a nice provocative way of saying we need to look at maybe using positive psychology instead of focusing on, are you depressed, are you anxious, why don't we give them a toolkit to be self-effective and self-manage?
I think those tools should be taught to adult gastroenterologists. I think we are less knowledgeable about these issues. Moreover, I don't think that frequently the adult GI office is set up in terms of an integrated model when it comes particularly to psychological support. And so, again, I think that communication between the pediatric team and adult team is critical for children that have coping issues, psychiatric issues, family stressors, even more so in those patients.
Yeah, that's great. So, you know, what I love about is that now we're going to get into all the clinical nitty-gritty, which I believe is very important. But as we said at the meeting, is that if we don't manage all of the life cycle issues that we kind of keep separate and focus only on the medical management, we're missing at least 50% of the story, right, with these chronic diseases.
We have the same experience in the adults. I mean, you know, to the extent that you're not aware of family stressors, financial issues, pain management issues, all of this is going to complicate the management of the disease. You have to treat the entire human being.
So the key themes today in the clinical side of things, which maybe we'll take some clinical pearls that we'll share with the viewers. Let's start with Ed Loftus' talk on skin manifestations and how we should be managing when a patient comes in with, there's multitude of skin manifestations of IBD, but I think the one that generated the most discussion was when a patient is on a TNF who gets a skin reaction, most of the time it was a psoriasiform eczema or dermatitis type, on TNF, patients are doing well, but they're having a skin manifestation. And how do you approach it? And do you differentiate those that could be treated topically versus those that are a little bit more intense? And what is the next best approach to that patient?
I think it's a great question, and it has to do with also our stewardship of medical therapies, because we don't have an unlimited number of medical therapies. And this is a classic example of successful medical therapy, which, on the other hand, has some issues associated with it. So typically, I think that practice and published experience bear out the fact that most of these patients can be managed successfully by a dermatologist. So that's what I will do. I will refer the patient to a dermatologist, preferably someone who has experience in this. And I think that with topical therapies, especially in mild to moderate cases, these patients are able to continue on therapy and manage at the same time the skin manifestations.
So I think what he was kind of selling us is that if it's manageable by topicals, with a partnership of the dermatologist, have them see the dermatologist, then you stay on course. If it's associated with, for example, alopecia or significant secondary infections in the scalp lesions, and obviously that's very distressing to a lot of our patients, then he basically was teaching us that moving to another TNF is probably not the right move. And one of the things he was suggesting that this may be, now that ustekinumab is available, that may be a good niche window for where that therapy for Crohn's would be effective. And so I think one of the most controversial points for which you and I actually debated, which was maybe heated, which combines with another debate on therapeutic drug monitoring, is this whole idea of how do we optimize biologic therapy? Do we need a concomitant immunomodulator like we've been taught forever, especially since Sonic for 7 years ago? Is there new information to say, if we had to tell the audience, in the current state of data, which is what you kind of taught me today, was that, you know, today, Marla, this is what we have. What would you tell the audience about the role of combination therapy? How long? What's really the role of combination therapy, and do we have alternative ways of approaching that problem?
Again, that is a common clinical dilemma. Combination therapy is the most effective therapy, but carries a risk of, particularly with the use of thiopurines, the risk of EBV lymphoma and a type of lymphoma that affects young people who are EBV negative and have a primary EBV infection. Again, combination therapy appears to be, more effective than monotherapy as induction, in approaching induction of Crohn's disease and ulcerative colitis. The data are that there are no more infections with combination therapy, and probably in that short span of time, there's no greater incidence of malignancies. Now, the data are far muddier when it comes to maintenance therapy, and of course, the longer you are on therapy, the higher the cumulative risk of various neoplasms, for example, skin cancers or lymphoma. And what I learned today from you is that the benefit, the incremental benefit of combination therapy over anti-TNF monotherapy, it basically derives from the optimization of the anti-TNF pharmacokinetics via the use of the immunomodulator. And so if there is another way to optimize the anti-TNF pharmacokinetics, then why not do so and therefore avoid the risk of lymphoma? And so I think you are a part of a group and you lead a group that is looking at pharmacokinetics in the early stage of treatment and how adjustments in the infliximab dosing can be just as effective as combination therapy in that setting. You want to talk to us about that?
I mean, you bring up what I like that you also said is, you know, we're looking at it. And I think one of the things you brought up was that we really need to compare the gold standard best induction with combination thiopurine plus TNF versus optimized TNF from minute one, meaning from the minute you enter on a TNF and you're using, we're looking at using a pharmacokinetic model where it's literally a PK model using Bayesian modeling, which sets its stage on a priori, meaning what it should be doing, and then you add in the patient-specific variables, and the model readjusts and says, oh, for this patient, you should use 10 milligram per kilogram every 5 weeks, because it actually down to the milligram per kilogram based on body mass index, CRP, albumin, height, weight, disease activity, and presence or absence of antibodies, as well as the drug level that the patient was able to achieve. So we're looking at using that early, meaning in the induction phase.
It's interesting. So the model you just described, it contains all the factors that we know already to affect infliximab pharmacokinetics. Were there any other parts of the model that was surprising that entered the model that were beyond known factors, BMI, gender, use of immunomodulator? Well, in this case, you're not using the immunomodulator. Was there any additional thing you learned?
The albumin is the thing that influences most PK, but if you put it in order, albumin and then the drug level. So without the drug level, it doesn't perform as well. So that's, I think, the point is that if you get a drug level early, my point, I guess, in the debate was that maybe you can negate having to use an immunomodulator if you would just optimize in induction your biologic monotherapy. So I think that is an interesting next step in our research.
And what you told us is basically this: in that early setting with a high inflammatory burden of disease, you do use a little bit more infliximab exactly to optimize the pharmacokinetics. But in the long term, you actually come out even or even better.
Cost-wise, it's even better, to be honest. And the exposure is basically the same. I mean, if you looked at total exposure over a year, because we were able to de-escalate a lot of patients in the maintenance.
Yeah. Well, all I can say is if that is borne out, if we can get more data out, then I think we're going to see a dramatic shift because it'll be really a paradigm shift in the management of Crohn's disease and UC.
And we also talked briefly that with the newer biologics, which is also a paradigm shift, like vedolizumab or ustekinumab, the preliminary data we have suggests that the anti-drug antibody rates are much lower than the TNF, so it could be that those adoption of those therapies may also reduce the need for combination immunomodulator. Yeah.
Having said that, we don't want to be absolute. Yeah. You know, we know that the thiopurines and methotrexate have a role to play, particularly in the maintenance of steroid-induced remission. But again, I think we're seeing a shift under our feet. The ground is shifting under our feet in terms of old therapies, what we've learned about them, and new therapies coming in. So I don't think that thiopurines and methotrexate are gone, but they're certainly beyond middle age.
Yeah. Oh, that's nice. So let's just end with kind of, I want your take. You were involved in the last debate that we're going to mention, which is this idea of, do we treat the symptoms or do we treat to the mucosa? I think we all believe fundamentally that if you achieved complete mucosal healing, a Crohn's patient will have less surgeries, I think.
Absolutely.
A UC patient would have less colectomy, right? That's not up for debate. Can we get there in the current treatment strategies we have and at what cost? And you were passionate about that, so maybe share a few thoughts on that.
Well, we've already incorporated endoscopic healing in our practice. I mean, whether we like it or not, we've been influenced by the dramatic or the significant, rather, endoscopic healing results of combination therapy. And so we're already using very effective therapy. We're not using the old paradigm of steroids, aminosalicylates. But we know drugs that have now very limited role in the management of Crohn's disease. So the standard of care is really risen. And we, many of us are following hemoglobin, albumin, CRP, etc. So the question is, taking the patient you just described, the patient you're already optimizing with combination therapy, or even better, with model-predicted or model-dictated dose changes. And in this patient, you don't end up with endoscopic healing. Then what do you do? So I think that, you know, I'm everybody's in agreement that multiple studies have shown a reduction of colectomy, need for steroids, and you see multiple studies have shown the same thing in Crohn's disease, reduction of hospitalizations, surgeries, steroid exposure. There's no question about that. But I think over time we've become so good at treating the disease that incremental changes, incremental improvements need perhaps new drugs, and perhaps a higher cost. So that's something we need to look at. So I'm all for mucosal healing. I just think that you know, when you work in a tertiary referral center and you see patients who come in with optimally dosed drugs and they have a little bit of residual disease, then what do you do with them?
I think you're right. So I think our discussion really brought out kind of the key points that we wanted to share with the viewers. And in addition to these discussions, we also talked about new therapies, which will be exciting coming out. Hopefully, towards the end of the year, we'll have tofacitinib, and the future remains bright. So I hope you enjoyed our discussion about the key insights from the great debates and updates in inflammatory bowel disease, and I'd like to thank Thamos for joining me today.
My pleasure.
Thank you.